Okay.
What? Thank you.
My pleasure. Talking louder is not a problem. Talking slower is a problem, not louder. Okay, so in the book of Bereshit, he goes through, this is the difference between the new one and the other one is only slight. What she started doing was sending out, you said you have the Gil Yonot.
I have the Gil Yonot.
So she would send out to a list of thousands of students these weekly parsha sheets where she would develop an idea and send it out with sources. They were unbelievably difficult. My Tawfiq Chumash teacher used to give it to us and like laugh while she watched us, you know, break our teeth over this stuff. I never quite figured it out. But then she afterwards actually wrote books. So this is based sort of on the Gil Yonot, on those sheets, but she elaborated on them and she wrote it in book form and developed the ideas for you. So that's, you know, what's very exciting about this. She passed away only very recently, I believe within the last 10 years. The other biography source is in a book called Tales of Nakama, which is a recently published book by a student of hers, I believe, named Leah Abramowitz, which I have at home. It's very interesting.
Leah?
Do you know her?
No, about, yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So she published this biography of her that half of it is a biography and half of it is recollections of her students, and it's really very nice. So, I never had the privilege of learning from her directly, but I did, okay? And Esther mentioned before she had the privilege of davening with her, and my husband did have the privilege of learning in a class with her. It was the class in which he stopped chewing gum, because there was a guy in the class was chewing gum, and she said she hates gum. I'll tell you in Hebrew and then in English. She said, it returns man to his beast dull state of being a beast. So since then, he stopped chewing gum. I wasn't in that class, so I haven't stopped chewing gum.
1 week.
I just, what?
I studied,
with her for a week. So it's, but I do consider myself somewhat of a student of hers through her writings and stuff like that. So it's a little ironic that we're going to be sitting in this class, and it's going to be mostly lecture form, but part of that is because it is late at night. And we'll work through it together. I'm hoping it'll also be discussion. But it's ironic because what Nachama's big thing is active learning. She said, your students don't learn by you telling them what the information is. So I do model my own classes in high school, especially she trained a lot of high school teachers. She wrote a lot of books about teaching high school, and I've devoured every single one. My favorite story about it is that after my second week of teaching the story of the Akedah, of Akedah Yitzchak, the binding of Isaac, at the end of my second week, I decided I'm going to look in her book I'm teaching, the book of Bereshit, and say, what does she say so I can get like a really good ending? So I start reading her two-page article that she wrote on it, and it starts from the beginning, you should not spend more than two class periods studying Akedah Yitzchak. This is at the end of my second week of double periods. Okay. I since learned a lot from her. So she starts off with the book of Shemot with a fabulous introduction, which we're not going to do. So we're going to do the first one. I forgot to bring the Chumashim in. Okay. There's like a cart. You know what I'm talking about? I'm really like behind today. My head is not used to. Thank you very much. Okay. It feels like this morning. It was Wednesday. No, normal. Now I could use the jet lag as an excuse. Normally I just use my ditziness, natural ditziness as an excuse. So don't be Miss Kobel. Thank you. Okay. All right. So here we go. We're going to, she sets it out for us. The first chapter of the book of Shemot subdivides into three sections. If you could share together. With you, that would be good. The first section, the second section, and the third section. First section is 1 to 6, which we'll see in a moment when Beth comes back. The first generation, their arrival in Egypt, and their disappearance from the scene. It talks about the brothers coming down. It says, these are the names of the people, the sons of Yaakov, who came down to Mitzrayim, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zvulun, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Binyamin. Yosef is not in the picture. Why? But Yosef was already in Mitzrayim, and that's what the pasuk says, and Yosef was already in Mitzrayim, and they all died. And that's right. The end of the sixth sukkim. It happens, yeah. Okay. Next section. Begins the second generation. She's going to bring this in. This is, let's pause for a moment. You can pass out the permission. I'm going to have to pause this. We're looking at the first chapter of the book of Shemot, which is on page 292. Okay. These are the names of the children of Israel who came down to Shem, Yaakov, and each man of his family came. Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, Binyamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher, like I said before. And by he called Nefesh, Yosef, Yarech, Yaakov, Shibit, Nefesh. There were 70 people altogether. Actually, as a total side point, if you go back in the end of Bereishit and you actually count them, it's really 68, but that's a whole other class for a whole other time. But a lot of fun. Okay, Yosef was in Mitzrayim already. Yosef died, and all the brothers in the whole generation. And then you have starting in Pasuk Zion, in verse 7, Ubnei Yisrael paru v'yishrutu v'yirbu v'yatmu b'ma'ol mod v'kimalei ha'aretz otam. You begin with the extraordinary fertility of the Jewish people. And then a new king comes up to Mitzrayim who didn't know Yosef, and he says to everybody, we have a people and we have to take care of them. Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more numerous and stronger than we. Come, let's outsmart it, lest it become numerous, and it may be that if a war will occur, it too may join our enemies and wage war against us and go up from the land. So they have taskmasters over to afflict the Jewish people of the burdens. They built storage cities, but as much as the Egyptians afflicted the Jewish people, that's how much. Could you pass me a tissue, please, over there, Rebecca? Can you put a tissue behind you? Thank you. That's how much the Jewish people would increase. Thank you so much.
Give me back my tissue.
This woman is unbelievable. I was all prepared here. Okay. Were you a Girl Scout?
I was a campfire girl.
Oh. Are campfire girls as prepared as Girl Scouts? Oh, good. Okay. I was a Girl Scout. Yeah. For a year. Okay. The Egyptians enslaved the children of Israel with crushing harshness. They embittered their lives with hard work, with mortar, with bricks. I mean, things were really, really bad. Then the king of Egypt turned to the Hebrew midwives. This is the third section, is the story of the midwives, of whom the name of the first was Shifra and the name of the second was Puah. There's a really good shiur about this on Falter.net by me, about who were the midwives. Although Nechama, of course, gives a way better one in her book, and when you get it, you can read it, even though we're not doing it on this parsha, but it's here, on who the midwives were, because the Shifra and Puah are names of people that we don't know. So the Midrash identifies them as people that we do know, as Miriam and Yocheved, or Miriam and Tzipporah. There are two opinions in the Midrash. But you got to read Nechama. She's, well, okay. All right, so he turns to them and he says, when you deliver the Hebrew women and you see them on the birth stool, if it's a son, you have to kill him. If it's a daughter, she could live. But the midwives feared God. They didn't do what the king of Egypt said to them. They caused the boys to live. King of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing that you've caused the boys to live? The midwives said to Paro, because the Hebrew women are unlike the Egyptian women. They're experts. Before the midwife comes to them, they have given birth. The actual Hebrew doesn't say they're experts. It actually says they're animals. Kichayot, hena. They are animals. They birth like animals with no assistance whatsoever. You don't see like a tiger midwife, you know, assisting the mother tiger in her birthing process. So they just, you know, boom, before we get there, they're done. God benefited the midwives and the people increased, became very strong, and it was because the midwives feared God that he made them houses. Paro commanded everyone, saying, every son that will be born into the river shall he throw him, and every daughter shall he keep alive. End of chapter 1.
What does houses mean?
So that's a good question. Either actually literal houses, or Rashi explains that this is future benefit for them, that Hashem gave them future reward, the house of Kehuna and the house of Malchut, that they got that as, and the way that works is the house of Kehuna from Yocheved, because she had Miriam and Aaron, and they're all from Levi. And the Malchut, the Melucha, the kingship, came from Miriam married Kalev ben Yefuna, who was from the Shevet of Yehuda. And that Shevet, there's the... Okay, so that the house of king and the house of Kehuna. Right. Right. Actually, though, if you see, look on the bottom also, Rashbam explains, like I said, actual houses, that if you look in the text, it's unclear who the pronouns are referring to. And it's possible that the pronoun is referring to Paro giving them houses, and the houses that he's giving them is that he's putting them under house arrest because they violated his decree. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Because they violated his decree, therefore he put them under house arrest. But yeah, he made them houses. there's a ton of syntactical stuff to do in here also that enables you to go all over the place. Okay, so this is what she addresses is the literary style. A study of the literary, the second chapter begins, what's the right, the very beginning of the second chapter? A man went from the house of Levi, he took a daughter of Levi, the woman conceived, gave birth to a son, she saw he was good, she hid him for 3 months, she couldn't hide him anywhere, she put him in a basket, the sister saw it, he was in the water. Who's this story about?
Moses.
The entire second chapter, the main character is?
Moses.
Baby Moses in the basket, right? That's the entire second chapter, what it's about. Total change of style. First chapter, who's the main character? The Jewish people, the children of Israel, this whole, and the Mitzvim, they're like, you have two co-stars over here. In chapter two, Herbet, Moshe. He's the star. And his name isn't even mentioned until halfway through. So here's what Nechama says. A study of the literary style of these two chapters. I'm going to paraphrase as we read along. I'm reading her. I'm using her as a jump-off point. But I'm going to, when I read it aloud, I'll paraphrase in easier. Because I know you'll space in and out, you know. Okay. The study of the literary aspects of the two chapters shows how clearly the Torah tells us this teaching, not by telling us directly, not by direct teaching, by like putting a moral at the end of the story, but by the actual narrative, the actual structure and style, and the organization of the plot. I'm not going to go through all the footnotes in the back, although I do recommend them, and I photocopied them for you. But she brings another quote talking about how the Torah tells us the message in the style in which it's written. We did this last semester in Tehillim. We saw, for instance, in Mizmor Shir Liyom HaShabbat, the parak that we read for Shabbos in Tehillim has no mention of Shabbos in it. However, it showed Hashem's name, what was it, 7 times? And there were all these like stylistic hints to the 7 days. That there were, if you divide the parak into half, there were 52 words in the first half, 52 in the second half, symbolizing 52 Shabbatot of the year. There were several 7 things, 7 groupings of 7. So, you know, there you see that in the style itself, the message is being imparted, not just didactically, not just being taught that way. So it says this is how the Torah is written. All the stories of the book of Bereishit, following creation, are centered around personalities, like Adam, Cain, Noah, the Avot. In Lech Lecha, Vayera, you have Abraham. In Tozot, you have Yitzhak. In Vayeshem, Vayeshach, you have Yaakov. But the first chapter of Shemot is the very first occasion after the disappearance of the first generation of Yaakov and his sons from the scenes where the grandchildren are referred to as a people. All of a sudden, they've transformed from a family to a nation. This title stresses their people, stressing their peoplehood is first accorded them by their archenemy. Who's the first one who calls them by this title, people? It's in Pasuk, right, Paro himself, in Pasuk Chet, by Yomer Elamo, where Paro turns to his nation, he says, Hine am b'nei Israel. This nation of the Jewish people is too many. That's the first person who refers to the Jewish people as a people, is Paro, is their enemy. One people confronted another, the one, ancient, populous, richly endowed culturally, rooted in its homeland, meaning Mitzrayim, the other, the Jewish people, the descendants of 70 souls forced to flee their homeland on account of famine. The strong resented the weak. No central personality has as yet emerged from the narrative. The hero of the first chapter is the people. An anonymous, amorphous body, a body without shape, to whose doings only one verse is at present devoted. All we know, at this point, when power comes on the scene, all we know about the Jewish people is what's written in Pasuk Zayin in verse 7. Uvenei Yisrael paru v'yishritzu v'yirbu v'yatzmu b'ma'on ma'od. And the translation here in the book is phenomenal. It is the best translation I have found of this pasuk anywhere. The children of Israel proliferated, swarmed, multiplied, and grew more and more. You see how the crescendo is building and building and building. The translation is great. Okay. This is a very odd verse. Stylistically, there are 4 almost synonymous verbs of increase that seem to gain momentum, so you climax by the double-barreled adverbial intensifier. Oh, no, okay, I'll explain that in regular words. Okay. You have 4 synonymous verbs here. Paru, they're proliferated. Vayishritzu, they swarmed. Vayirbu, they multiplied. Vayatzmu, they grew. And then you have at the end, be ma'od, ma'od, a lot, a lot. Like, what's going on here? There is no, The Torah doesn't waste words. The Torah doesn't waste letters. Nothing is extra, et cetera, right? What's with all these verbs here for? Rashbam attempted to differentiate between the different connotations of the verbs, and if anyone's interested in the Hebrew source of the Rashbam, I have it here, but we're going to be doing it primarily in English, but if anyone wants, I made 10 copies of this also, you have to share these too. But then we're going to do the second part on this sheet in a minute. So he attempts to differentiate as follows. Haru. And they were fruitful in pregnancies. They're pregnant quite often, he says. The Yisrachu, they swarmed with live births. Because tiny creatures are invariably described in scriptures as shoreit al haaretz, swarming on the ground. The Yerbu, they increased in size, meaning the small actually grew bigger. They didn't die in infancy. And by Yatmu, they grew. Not only did they not die in infancy, they didn't die in manhood, and they were numerous, and they became very powerful. So he takes what Rashbam does. Okay, slight digression. There are two different ways to view a pasuk like this in the Torah. When you have a pasuk that repeats a lot, there are two different ways to view it. One way is what we call super significance. Every single word in this pasuk has a slightly different connotation, and that's why each word is used. But there's another way to view it also. That's just the stylistic way of writing. Okay, Rashbam was the grandson of Rashi. Rashi was the guy who sat through all the ancient writings, all the midrashim, and he picked out the ones that you should know. And that's what he wrote as his interpretation on the Torah. Rashbam is his grandson. He said, Rashi, it's very nice that you brought all these midrashim along, but you're sort of deviated from the straight meaning of the text. So Rashbam, like, he comes in here and he explains very literally what each word actually means, that each one has a slightly different connotation. Ibn Ezra, who was a contemporary of Rashbam on the other side of the Jewish world, Rashbam was in France, Ibn Ezra was in Spain, even though geographically they're very close, philosophically, in terms of Jewish tradition, they are worlds apart. So I brought that source for you on the left-hand side, but if you'll turn in your booklet to page 21, it's there too. Ibn Ezra gives something similar. Here's what he says. Haru means they brought forth children like a tree gives forth its fruit, that easily. Vayishritzu, like let the waters swarm, which is what happens, what Hashem says when he creates the waters and the creatures in the water. Except, now skip to right after the parentheses. You see where it says perhaps the word Vayishritzu? This is the part that fascinates me. Okay, perhaps the word Vayishritzu implies that their wives bore twins or a greater number in a single birth. I myself have seen four children born in one birth, and the doctors say that the number can be as high as seven. This is very indicative of Ibn Ezra's commentary in general. I'm trying to throw a lot of things in here. Okay, this is very indicative of Ibn Ezra's commentary in general. He incorporates modern science into his commentary. It's a very interesting kind of thing, where he says the doctors say, for him to introduce the concept of a doctor in his commentary on the Torah, is a very interesting thing.
When is this, when did he live?
He lived around the 11th, 12th century. Let's see. Somewhere around there. I know that's a big gap, but I could tell you more specifically
well,
after.
All right.
Okay.
That's only 1,000 years from.
Right. Only.
Only.
Isn't that funny? We were at, here. Somebody, there was a young man in shul this past Shabbos from a Catholic high school doing a report on Jews. Are you familiar with this? Are you aware of this? So I was introduced to him after shul. And I said, what were your impressions? What was it like? He said, well, I didn't really understand anything, but I understood the rabbi's sermon. And I said to him, well, you should know that that's a relatively new development. Only within the last 100 years has the rabbi given his sermon in English. And I thought to myself, like, to us, for me to say in the last 100 years, that is a relatively new development when our heritage goes back 5,000 years. To an American whose heritage only goes back 200 years, you know, like, oh, it's a new thing only in the last 100 years. Like, I came off down. It was funny. All right. Okay. But everything is relative, you know, but that is, I can throw in another interesting book to read. I forgot what it was called, though, so remind me after. Okay. But it's about the beginner of Reconstructionist Judaism, whose name is, thank you, Mordechai Kaplan, A Heretic in the Modern, no, that's a different book. An excellent book about Mordechai Kaplan. If you're interested, I'll tell you the title afterwards. He grew up as an Orthodox Jew and as an Orthodox rabbi, and then developed Reconstructionist Judaism because he felt that all the people in Orthodoxy like had no feeling. They were just performing without feeling. Can't imagine where he would get that feeling from. So he developed Reconstructionist, which is feeling without performing, but okay. My yerbu. What? Okay, my yerbu. Their mortality was not high as is usual with large masses of people. But yeah, it's smooth. They were strong. And the phrase bimodmon means to the fullest extent. So Ibn Ezra also goes through each phrase and gives it a slightly different connotation to it. Back to page 13. Okay. It is, to say the least, questionable whether these four verbs can be conveniently pigeonholed into expressing mutually exclusive categories of increases, Rashbam suggested. Rashbam suggested like that each one means a totally different thing. He said, probably doesn't mean that each thing means a totally different, separate thing, but they're sort of building on each other to reach this crescendo, and she says this is a stylistic device that the Torah is using. It's like if we were, I wish I knew Biblical Hebrew, because then you would really get the Torah, you know? Like, you know when you take, I speak about music appreciation all the time, and I took that one stinking semester of music appreciation in college. Like, since I felt like I was an expert in music, and I have to tell you, listening to a piece of music, the teacher got up on the first day of class, and he said, I hate going to the grocery store when they play classical music. Because to me, it's not background music. And, like, for a couple semesters after that, I really felt very similar to it. I got very into the class. I get into things, you might notice. But to hear the chachma, the brilliance in these compositions, and to hear how everything fits together, and like if you really, you can really follow, if you really understand what music is about, then you really appreciate it. So I feel like with here, Nachama is trying to explain to us what it's all about. That the words that are being used are building on each other to come to a crescendo. It's not what the words mean. It's how they're being used. It's the language. It's the sounds. It's the style that's giving us the meaning. It's not just the words themselves. Let's turn to page 14. This is translated in English. The Hebrew is very sophisticated Hebrew. Right. Yes. She wrote beautifully. I mean, really beautifully. No, this is translated and adapted, actually. Right. That's what I'm saying. Her Hebrew was exquisite, but okay. It was this body of people that became the object of Egyptian measures of enslavement. Note how the wording foregrounds this relationship. It gives us a hint. Verbs of servitude and suffering are invariably associated with Israel as the object or target of Egyptian activity. And if you look, you can look in a number of places here. Some of the psukim are on page 14, but I recommend turning to page 294 for the English and using the source number 2 that I gave you on this sheet. 295 for the English. I underlined, if you see, I'll read it through for you with my own translation. And they put, and notice which kinds of verbs are associated with which of the protagonists, which of the main characters. They put upon them taskmasters in order to afflict him with their suffering. And he built, or they built, cities of treasure house cities for Paro, Pitom and Ramses. And the more they afflicted them, the more they grew and multiplied. And they were, as you say, they became disgusted. The Egyptians became disgusted because of the Jewish people. Until now, these two psukim, there's no main character presented. It's just pronouns. He, they. Clearly, one person is the attacker, one person is the victim. And which side is which? It tells us in the next pasuk, Vayavidu Mitzrayim Epnei Israel. The Mitzrayim made the Jewish people work hard. How hard? The farech, with back-breaking work. it wasn't just physical backbreaking work. The Midrash, the Gemara explains that they would give the women the men's jobs and give the men the women's jobs. So the men were, I'm stereotyping here, because that was sort of the whole point. The men were doing the laundry and the cooking and washing floors, and the women were quarrying the stones. Emotionally, to switch what you're used to from your job is a very, it's a very scary thing. It's a terrible thing. They embittered their lives with hard work, with bricks and mortar, and all the field work, all of the work that they made them do, backbreaking work, with rigor, with very hard work. The clear, so now we're going back to page 14, in the middle of the page. Explicit reference to the subject and the object, the attacker and the victim, Mitzrayim and Bnei Israel, in verse 13 is redundant. And it doesn't make sense grammatically. The pronouns they and them is enough. Why do you have to keep saying, like, the pronouns are there, and then in the middle you throw in who the attacker is and who the victim is? And I pointed that out to you, that the attacker and victim aren't mentioned until then. But if you turn to the page before, when Paro is saying, well, what should we do to the Jewish people? In the Chumash, sorry. Well, what should we do to the Jewish people? It's clear who the perpetrator is and who the victim is. So why do you need to throw it in? She quotes she introduces at this point an interpreter named Benno Jacob. I'm going to read to you. In the back of the first volume, she lists all the commentators that she uses. Benno Jacob lived at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. He was a German-Jewish Bible scholar, a graduate of Breslau Seminary, and a disciple of Gratz. Does anybody know who Gratz was? A historian. Was he an Orthodox historian?
No.
Not quite. Here is something unique about Nachama Leibowitz. I got in trouble for doing this at Akiva, but I did it anyway. She taught the commentaries written by people who did not live their lives according to Torah values. But if that individual comment that they made was not antithetical to our values, to Torah values, she used it. She said, I don't care if you're not an Orthodox Jew. If you say something that fits in, that doesn't contradict the concept of the Torah coming from Shemayim, of the Torah always being relevant to us. If what you're saying doesn't contradict it, I'll bring it. I can learn from that too. To me, that's an unbelievable thing. And that was a breakthrough. It didn't really break all the way through, but it's an unbelievable, I liked it, so I taught it. And then I had a teacher come to me and say, you're teaching that person in your class? And I said, yeah. And that was it. I didn't really get in trouble. Okay. Right, but I explained that it was a non-Orthodox rabbi, and he brought his introduction. It was a different. It was not Benno Jacob, but Benno Jacob is in that same category. This other rabbi who I was referring to wrote a fabulous introduction to the Torah. I couldn't pass it by. So there you go. Okay, Benno Jacob. Echoes Ramban. She refers to this, you can read Ramban if you want on your own. In noting how the text nowhere reports that the Egyptians actually changed the status of the Israelites from foreign residents into slaves. There was no formal public act of enslavement published by Paro. Like, he didn't hang up a sign, he didn't publish anything in the newspaper that says, now the Jews are going to be slaves. He can't. It would have been terribly illegal, even for him, to enslave people who had been invited to settle in the country by royal permission and agreement. How did the Jews get there in the first place? Paro, the previous Paro, invited them to come, gave them a whole area of the land to live in. So he can't now come and revoke that status. Indeed, in theory, they were never formally indented as slaves. Paro never refers to them as slaves. But in practice, they were enslaved. But the Torah removed the veil from the political chicanery and called a spade a spade. The Torah tells you clearly what the situation was like. That is why this passage, which contains the first mention of their enslavement, spells out in so many words who initiated the serfdom, against whom it was perpetrated. Now I want to show you something else that you point out. For this reason too, the Hebrew root, avad, I invest, dalet, serve, recurs five times. In source number two, the first time I took the part that we spoke about just before, and I underlined all the verbs, the attacking verbs, the afflicting verbs. But in the second part, I boxed off every time the shoresh, I am that dalet of working, of making some, of enslaving, shows up. Five times in a very short span of time. Very short section of Sukkim. Five times that shows up. Wow. Meaning, even though Paro never explicitly refers to the Jews as slaves, the Torah is telling you, stylistically, it's using the style to tell you, they were slaves. No two ways about it. Okay. Please.
Is there a source for something that I learned that the method that they used was to call like a campaign for patriotism, and Harold came with everybody and they said everybody should volunteer and help build these.
That's how it started, yeah. So man talks about the different levels. Right. So that's what he was referring to. He said it like that. Come volunteer. You know, and then he said everybody has to give a certain amount of work per year. You have to put in 2 weeks a year, like a work tax, sort of. And then when he saw that wasn't working, he told the Egyptians that anyone who needed work done in their house, they should stand on the corners and pull in the Jews. They could pull in whoever they want to work. So that it was a gradual process like that. That's exactly, you're exactly right. Okay, in the middle of page 15. This stylistic device, meaning the five times of this root showing up, acts as the backcloth for the next scene. I, ear, and memory have been tuned into the opening words of the Ten Commandments. What does it say right at the very beginning of the Ten Commandments? I am the Lord thy God who brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of serfdom, me Beit Avadim. Remember, don't think that it wasn't a Beit Avadim. Then O Jacob observed that the Egyptian subject or initiator of the act of enslavement is plural, and the Jews are always singular. Okay, we're going to skip that part, just because I'm trying to move a little faster. Okay, what you were talking about is right at the bottom of 15, the top of page 16. That the Egyptian people, it was the entire people that were involved, not just the individual leader, the bottom 15. The individual, too, was heavily involved in the process of oppression and enslavement. Accordingly, punishment was to be meted out not only on Paro, on the people as a collective group, but also on each individual Egyptian. The same point is made by Ramban in his comment. They set over them taskmasters to oppress them. Here's what he says. At first, the Israelites were ordered to supply the king with a fixed quota of labor. The king appointed Egyptian officers to mobilize the labor force, perform their duties by rotation, a month or more, and construction work for the king. But when they saw that wasn't working, they decreed that all the Egyptians enslaved the people. Any Egyptian who required labor was authorized to press the Israelites into his service. And that's why it says the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. In contrast to that, when the subject of Israel is Israel, the predicates speak of servitude and increase. Those are the two verbs that are referred to with the Jewish people. Verse 7 we already spoke about, but that was the Haru Vayishra, so Vayir, they asked him to go on the Ode. But soon after that, it talks about them building these store cities. The more they increased and spread abroad, the people increased and became very strong. We're not told how the Jewish people reacted to the policy of oppression, if they opposed it or accepted it with resignation. All the Torah says is that they kept on multiplying. The irony of this response, according to our sages, is it's very language-related. When Paro first makes his plan against the Jewish people, he says we have to make a plan against them 10 years back so that they will not produce. The Jewish people's response is Cain, you're back. Yes, we will. We will multiply. It's a wordplay. Top of page 17. The picture drawn here of Israel is one of unrelieved gloom, characterless and faceless, devoid of personalities and bereft of leadership, a suffering, downtrodden mass with no heroic figures. But the opposite of true is true in the second chapter. One family, a father, mother, and daughter, emerges from the gloomy fastness of the faceless, characterless multitude. True, for the time being, they too are nameless, but they have character. They're distinctive. It's at this juncture that the hero is born. At first, he is also nameless. He's called the son, he's called child, he's called the youth. I mentioned that when we started reading it, that he's not referred to by name until the middle, until 10 took him in, when Paro's daughter pulls him out of the water, and she's the one who actually gives him the name. Henceforth, after that, he is Moses, occupying a central role throughout the chapter. Slowly, the fog begins to lift. The picture becomes clearer. With it, the murky clouds of persecution enveloping the people begin gradually to thin out. So you see, that whole first chapter is painting the Jewish people as under this like thick, heavy cloud of oppression. And they're trying to fight their way through it. They're trying to multiply despite the decrees. They're trying to push through and push on. And in the second chapter, when you have this one person coming up, all of a sudden things start being clearer. He actually has a name. It's an individual. He's actually identified. And the Midrash adds to this. She brings this in the middle of page 17. But Tereo Toki Tobu, when he's born, it says that the mother looked at him and saw that he was good. And the Midrash asks the question, doesn't every mother? Of course. So our sages said, he says, Chachamim Amrim B'Sha'as HaNolad Moshe, at the time when Moshe was born, Nitmalei Habayit Kulo Or. The house was filled with light. It was actually filled with light when he was born. And had Ketiv Hacha. Here it says Vatero Toki Tovu. Here it says she saw that it was good. Ketiv Hatam. And there it says Vayarel Kimata Orki Tov. And God saw the light that was good. So they're making that connection of light, of God, of good. You see Moshe. Moshe is the Savior. He's the messenger of God. He is light. He's bringing light to this very dark situation. In other words, Moshe's role in human history can be compared to that of light in the world of nature. No member of that enslaved and suffering multitude knew or wanted to know of the emergence of this luminary except for his father, mother, sister, and Paro's daughter. Nobody knew about it. Nobody wanted to. So now we shift gear. Let's now shift our attention from the things conspicuous by their presence in this chapter to something conspicuous by its absence. Until now, meaning until in the middle, after Moshe goes twice, he goes out and he intervenes on behalf of the Jewish people, and then he runs away to Midian, and then he saves the seven daughters of Yitro from the taunting of the shepherds, and he's brought back to Yitro's house. He marries Zipporah. They have a child. Things move very quickly in those days. Although you should just know that whole second chapter, from his birth to the time that his child is born, the Midrash has a phenomenal story about it. The precursor, I would say, to the Excalibur story with King Arthur. He talks about that Moshe, when he ran away from Egypt, he was 17, somewhere between the ages of 17 and 20 years old, and he comes to a city that is being besieged by Bilam, and he saves the city from the siege, and they appoint him king. There's a city in the lands of Cush, of Ethiopia. They appoint him king. He remains king there for 40 years. They give him a wife, with whom he does not consummate his marriage. Then after 40 years, he says, listen, I have to go. I don't remember exactly what that part of the story, how he extricated himself from there. He shows up in Midian, and in Midian, they take him as a prisoner because he's the stranger, and he says he's the king of Cush, and they don't believe him because he looks like a wayward traveler, and they put him in a prison. Now, in the meantime, in the backyard of Yitro's house, there has always been a stick in the ground. Sticking in the ground. And Zipporah is now of age to be married, and Yitro decides that whoever can pull the stick out of the ground can marry Zipporah. And all the men come from the land, I promise you, this is in the Midrash. And all the men come from around the land, they all come to try to pull out the stick. That stick has been there since Ma'aseh Bereishit, since the time of creation. They all try to pull out the stick, none of them could. Zipporah, in the meantime, saw that had met this prisoner. She fell in love with him. She kept bringing him food and bread and water for 10 years. This is going on. 10 years, like a long time. All these guys are trying. They're not pulling it out. She finally goes to her father, Yitro, and says, what about the prisoner? Let him try. He says, first of all, he's just a prisoner. Second of all, he's dead. He's been there for 10 years already. She said, well, no, he isn't. They pull him out. And lo and behold, boom, he pulls it out. Right? Excalibur. That's the story of the sword of King Arthur. He pulls it out, and that becomes his staff. That's Moshe, and that's his staff. It's in the Midrash. You can't. Okay. It's a really good, yeah, it's a good story. Anyway.
Staff's attention to the snake.
That's the very one. Yes, the staff. So through this whole time, through the whole chapter, we've been talking about what's in the chapter. We didn't talk about what's missing. Through the entire chapter, second chapter, there is no mention of God. Through our entire story, except for the mention of the midwives saying that they feared God and of God rewarding them, other than that brief mention, there's no mention of God. Where was he?
He was busy.
He was busy? Where was he?
He was hiding. He comes back and he sees the lights.
So she says in the bottom of page 17, she said, where had he disappeared to? Had he abandoned the world? Surely he had promised on the occasion of Jacob's departure for Egypt that I shall go down with you to Egypt and I'll raise you up from there. Where was he to be found in the light of the bondage, persecution, and suffering? It seems, she says, that the Torah is giving us, give expression, not by teaching again, but by following within the literary framework to show how the Jewish people felt. Of course God wasn't disappeared. Of course he was there. But the Jewish people felt as if he wasn't there, as if he was completely missing.
Like in the Second World War, they were abandoned.
Like a lot of times, yeah. Right. They felt, so it gave to the Jewish people a sense of abandonment by God in the midst of the suffering. Admittedly, patriarchal traditions coming from the Avot, a promise and fulfillment of an end of the exile and ultimate redemption had survived. They knew it was going to happen. But where was he now? Maybe this sense of gradual abandonment by God had been paralleled by his obvious actual obliviousness. Maybe he was actually oblivious to what was going on. The fact that he isn't there could symbolize that there was a separation between him and the bondage. His absence from the record were witness to a similar lacuna in their religious consciousness. She points out, and I think she refers to this in footnote number 7 also, yeah, that the Jewish people really didn't keep mitzvot when they were in Mitzrayim. You know that famous, there's a famous midrash that said, in Mitzrayim they never changed their names, their language, their clothing. If those are the things that they never changed, that means they changed everything else. So they're walking around with the names of Max and Sadie, but they're not doing anything. All they are, their names are still Goldberg and, you know, and Schwartz, but they didn't change, what was his name, Bernie Schwartz, too.
Tony Curtis.
Thank you. I knew somebody would know that reference. Yeah. But they, you know, they kept their name, but everything else totally went out the window. So it could be they felt abandoned by God. They dropped everything by the wayside. I don't know how they would do it anyway with under the enslavement the way it was. But all of a sudden, the darkness is pierced by this powerful beam of light of Moshe.
But they were having all these kids, and they were becoming a stagnation, and they still felt
completely disconnected. Look at what was happening to them, all the afflictions. I mean, they're having all these kids, and then they had to kill all the kids. Amram got up. The Midrash tells us that Amram, Moshe's father, got up as the head of the Jewish community, and he said, this is ridiculous. We're all having children so they could kill them? Divorce. And all the Jewish people divorce.
Right. This is in Egypt. They left Goshen.
They didn't only live in Goshen. That's correct. They lived among the Egyptians. What's the proof of that? When they left, they went to their neighbors, their Egyptian neighbors, to get the hay back, right? If they all lived in Borough Park, they wouldn't have any Egyptian neighbors, right? So they all lived, they didn't just live in Goshen. They were all over the place. But now in the end of Parakvet, the end of chapter 2, look at pages 300 and 301. The king of Mitzrayim dies. Vayehi bayamim harabim hahem. After many years. Vayamat melech Mitzrayim, the king of Mitzrayim died. Vayeanchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avodah. The Jewish people stretched out, so they cried out from the work. Vayizaku, and they screamed. I just want to give you a side point. Actually, you asked a very interesting question here. If the king died, why are they crying now? Shouldn't they be happy when the king died? Rashi's answer is, the king didn't actually die, but he got leprosy. He got charat, which is one of the things that they say is as if the Torah uses it as a euphemism, saying that he died when he got charat many times. said he got Shabbat. And why were they crying? Because he got into his head. His astronomers told him, his doctors told him that the way to cure his Shabbat was to bathe in the blood of Jewish children. And that's why the cries were getting stronger at this point. You don't think about the slavery in Egypt in real terms like that, usually. It's like something that happens a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But it's important to understand, really, it wasn't. In those days he died, the cries of an Israel pierced the heavens. V'ta'al shavatam el ha'elokim min ha'adama, min ha'avodah. Their screams reach up to God from the work. And count with me. V'ayishma elokim, number one, God heard at nakatam their cries. Number two, v'ayishkor elokim, God remembers his breach. At Abraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov, his agreement, his deal that he made with the Avos, with Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Vayar Elokim, number three, God saw B'nai Israel. And number four, the fourth reference to God in one pasuk, in two psukim, Vayeda Elokim. And God knew now was the time. God is absent all along. All of a sudden here at the end of chapter 2, right when our story is about to begin, is when he shows up five times. She says on page 19, God first appears in the role of object. He's the target of their groaning and cries. He's the one they're praying to, followed by four successive references, one after the other, to God, to him as God in the role of subject. It starts off saying that he's receiving, they're crying to him, and then boom, boom, things that he's doing. He heard, he remembered, he saw, and he knew. And Hashem's name, we mentioned before that it would be okay to just put a pronoun in, he, but the Torah doesn't use pronouns. It says Elohim, 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 four times, representing a foregrounding of the progressive reappearance of God as a factor in the life of Israel, the breaking down of barriers, resuming the link between the upper and lower worlds. God heard, remembered, saw, and heeded. The sudden and successive reappearance of the divine name in the text signaled the end of the period of his estrangement from the world. No longer would he work from behind the scenes, but would act openly in full public view, bursting forth into the arena of history with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. Moshe is the first person who gets a direct communication from God for the purpose of communicating it to other people. Until now, Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, she mentions this in her introduction, their Nevarot was only about them. They weren't told, tell the Jewish people this. There were no Jewish people. Moses, the first one, this is when it starts, got super involvement in the world. And the Jewish people as a nation starts here and now in this expression. Shabbat shalom.